incessantly, burping out a few more plaid flannel shirts each time. He noticed her noticing, and twitched to look over his shoulder, and she willed her eyes to become china plates fixed on his until he stopped.
"I'm Cal," he said, extending a hand. "And it's right around midnight, so you,"
he gestured toward the dingy marquee,
"must be Gretchen."
She wasn't, but he was so proud of that line, she knew immediately he didn't have any others. So she just nodded yes and grasped his warm hand, cracking open a little at the thought of all the things he was taking on faith. When she said, "Thanks, Cal," her voice broke again, not on purpose this time, and she pulled her hand back fast. He took a step forward, like you do when you see something just beginning to topple off a shelf. She righted herself and said, "So, where are you parked?"
"That way."
He pointed, and she let him march past her with just the faintest brush of shoulders, falling in a little behind. Giving him some time without her in his sight lines so that he could reflect on his unbelievable good luck. That idea was so sad she almost laughed. She hoped he would forget about the cigarettes because, although she could hold a lungful of pot for a minute and a half before letting it out, cigarettes made her cough and cough. He didn't forget. The car slowed down 5 blocks from the club and he prepared to turn into a gas station. "What I really am is hungry," she said suddenly, like a confession. "Are you hungry?"
"I could eat."
"Do you know anywhere that's open? I've only been to Seattle for gigs. I don't know anything around here."
"Sure, yeah."
Cal seemed unfazed by the sudden switch.
"Do you have to get back anytime soon?"
"I'm just hungry," she repeated. She wondered if they'd found her purse sitting under the stool yet, then realized Cal was saying something she'd missed. "I'm sorry, what? I'm..."
"You're tired, too,"
he said.
"I was just saying it was a great set. Are you always this worn out after a performance?"
"No," she said, leaning back into the passenger seat as the warm, familiar exhaustion of being borne away washed over her. A feeling of leaving. A perfect feeling, better than any safety in the world. She was glad when the diner turned out to be 15 minutes out along a highway between tall traffic barriers and taller trees. It was dark, but she could barely see the Space Needle poking up over a hill. That was how far away downtown was, with the club and the van and Will, who would by now be looking around impatiently, maybe sending someone into the ladies' room to check on her. Cal opened the door for her. The diner had steam on the insides of its windows and smelled wonderful. "This is perfect," she said as they slid onto the curved benches of wood grain formica. She ordered a burger and fries. Cal got a tuna melt with a salad.
"So you come up here for gigs a lot?"
Cal asked. "You should know." He blushed. Very pretty, she thought.
"Yeah, I've seen you a few times," he said carefully. "You guys play a lot in Portland?"
"A couple times a week," she said.
"How long have you been singing?"
She looked for something on the table to play with, found the ridged white salt shaker. "I've been with the band 6 months."
"Do you like it?"
"I like being good at it," she said.
"That's not really the same,"
he said.
"Do you like the feeling?"
"I like the feeling of being good at it."
"I mean, do you need to sing to live? Because when I see you up there, you look like you do."
"Well, I don't," she said, annoyed by the idea. "I'm just trying to do a good job."
"Well, that's what you look like. It's amazing to see. It's like nobody else should see it, you know?"
"Yeah, that's what Will thinks, too," she said with a short laugh. "I'm the only reason we're getting booked, or he'd lock me up and make me sing just for him."
"I didn't mean that," Cal said.
"I know you didn't, but that's what it's like." Cal furrowed his brow, obviously trying to think of something to say. She decided to save him the effort. "He hits me," she said levelly. "I'm running away from him."
"He hits you?"
"And I'm running away from him." He took the salt shaker out of her hands and set it up right in front of her. She could feel him taking in, for the first time, her lack of a coat, her lack of a purse. Now was the moment when he would also surmise correctly that he was buying her dinner. She tried not to hold her breath, waiting for his next question.
How can I help?
She looked into his eyes, which were dark brown, with watery blue rings around the irises, and made her voice soft.
You're helping right now? Didn't you know?
She took the shaker back and laid it on its side, spun it around so that a few tiny salt grains flew out onto the table with every whirl. She let the salt lie, knowing instinctively how much he wanted to sweep it away. He didn't. The food came. She picked up the burger and crammed in a bite. Out of the corner of her eye, she noticed Cal giving a thank you nod to the waitress, and only after she walked away did he unroll his fork and knife and spread the paper napkin in his lap. Then he picked up the knife and cut the sandwich in half, diagonally. Wow, she said.
What?
He picked up one triangle and bit off the corner. Her mouth full, she gestured toward his sandwich with the hamburger in her hands.
I like to eat one half at a time, in case I want to take the rest home, he said.
And I find triangles aesthetically pleasing.
That's creepy, she laughed. Like a serial killer.
How old are you?
He asked. What an impolite question.
Forget it, he said. You're obviously not old enough to want to hide your age, so you must be too young.
27.
Bullshit, he said.
How old are you? She put a French fry in her mouth, left it between her teeth for a moment too long before biting down. He raised an eyebrow at her.
Too old for you.
40?
Thanks, he laughed.
30, actually.
I'm 25.
Yeah, I bet,
he said.
Christ, shouldn't you be in college or something?
I graduated early, she said. I'm a fast learner.
How about that? Cal said.
You're not, though.
How do you know?
She aimed a French fry at his nose and fired, because you didn't see that coming. She hadn't seen it coming either. This flirtatious buoyancy was new to her. She'd never been anything but sultry or sweet with Will, as the situation demanded, with Lena silent and compliant. She wondered in a detached way how much of this was an act, how much a real response to the warm diner, the food hitting her stomach, her muscles relaxing, the absence of fear for the first time in months. Meanwhile, Cal was studying her with a serious expression.
Listen, Gretchen,
he said.
I can find you a place to stay for a while.
Can I stay with you? He hesitated.
Do you have anyone else you can call?
Do I look like I have anyone else I can call? She said with a gesture that took in the two of them, alone, and the midnight diner.
Well?
He paused, then sighed.
I guess you can crash at my place tonight.
You do this often? Offer strangers a bed?
I knew someone else who had to leave a bad situation in a hurry once,
he said, ignoring her provocation. She'd stopped listening, though, after the word tonight. The rest would come. Once she was inside his house, she knew well enough how to make it stick. She just didn't know it would stick for her, too. That was her mistake. 5. Alex Mercado looks about 10 years younger than any private investigator I've ever seen in a movie or TV show. He has a round, boyish face, tan and clean-shaven. To my relief, he's not wearing a fedora. I realize now that I've been picturing him in one because of the website, but of course he's dressed unobtrusively, in jeans and an untucked polo shirt. Nevertheless, in a Waffle House sparsely populated with single men drinking coffee alone in booths, I can tell right away which one is looking for me. And he confirms it by standing and leaning over to shake my hand across the booth.
I'm Alex. Thanks for coming,
he says, and gestures for me to sit across from him. The brown plastic of the booth squeaks as I slide toward the wall with its frosted glass partition on top. It's been a long time since I've been in a Waffle House. Looking around, I wonder if this is the type of place where my students hang out when they're hungover. Its smell, cinnamon apples and slightly rancid cooking oil, is strangely pleasant.
You come here often?
I ask. I think I've seen you here before. He looks slightly taken aback, and I think,
that's for the caller ID, buddy.
I just wanted somewhere we could talk without being interrupted, he says. His voice is a little raspy, but instead of making him seem older, it makes him sound almost adolescent, like his voice is breaking. He looks around and laughs. There's only one waitress working the floor right now, and believe me, she's not all that attentive. Just so you're aware, my husband knows I'm here.
Okay, he says. I can tell he doesn't believe me.
Shoot, I say, to get the pleasantries over with.
I know this is a delicate subject, he says, pronouncing the word delicate with more attention to each syllable than is usual. I know you're probably feeling very...
Yes, I am, I say. So what's all this about?
Have you talked to your daughter about what happened?
The police report.
I know what's in the police report.
You do? I have, of course, seen news footage from the press conference the police gave, but without the family there as a central attraction, it went fast. Just someone speaking the words safe and sound and human trafficking task force, and then safe and sound one more time amid flashing cameras while Julie's seventh grade picture floated in one corner and a banner scrolled across the bottom of the screen. Kidnapped 13-year-old home safe 8 years later. Certainly no details from the police report have been released to the public.
How do you know?
I read it, he says.
How? I'm a PI. I have my ways. But I didn't ask about the report. Have you talked to your daughter about what happened?
I was there when she gave her statement. He just looks at me. We don't spend every waking minute talking about it, I say, if that's what you mean.
You don't want to know?
I don't want to pry. Mrs. DeValos,
doctor,
I say without thinking, but he presses on.
Have you noticed any inconsistencies in Julie's story?
4 missed therapy appointments, a tattoo, the look on her face when she saw the ultrasound screen, her voice, get out.
Has it ever occurred to you to wonder?
He breaks off and drops his voice, putting on a serious face, not quite apologetic, but concerned.
Look, Mrs. Dr. DeValos, there have been cases of...
It's unusual, but frankly so is a missing child showing up on her own 8 years later out of nowhere.
Even after just 3 days, when no ransom has been set and there's a weapon involved, the likelihood of recovery...
I'm aware.
Now, the cops aren't going to question it. She's home, she's safe, and it's not their problem anymore.
They're still looking for... He cuts me off.
Sure. It would look great for them to pull in the bad guy after all this time, expose a human trafficking ring. Terrific headline, but I have to tell you, Doc, from what I read, that is one bizarre trafficking ring. You don't kidnap a kid in Texas and drag her across 3 states if you're trying to get her to Mexico. The border's right there.
Maybe the kidnapper didn't have a plan, I say.
Sure, Alex says. Maybe he's a garden variety psychopath. I mean, they're not that common, but maybe. And he sees her somewhere, who knows where, and takes her opportunistically on an impulse. And then he needs to get rid of her fast after.
Okay.
And he happens to bump into this trafficking ring, and she winds up in Mexico with El Jefe the drug lord, who lives on a compound right out of a movie.
He pauses, shakes his head.
That was a gutsy move, but smart.
What do you mean smart? I say. What move?
Because now the FBI is involved.
He started to talk more to himself than to me, the concern yielding to an expression I find almost unbearable, one of interest.
Then there's the statewide task force, HPD, and the county, all these levels trying to work together. Everything gets complicated and it gets slow. The investigation could drag on for months and months. And in the meantime, do you think the cops want her face in the media, reminding everyone how they dropped the ball for 8 years? Why do you think that press conference went by in such a hurry? You think they want to remind everyone that America's kidnapping sweetheart just wandered back on her own?
Alex has been talking rapidly, and now he pauses, so I know I am in for it.
Especially when she was probably right under their noses the whole time, and they didn't do anything to save her.
under there. But she's safe, I think. He pushes a large manila envelope across the table to me, and although I feel a warning signal going off somewhere in my head, don't open it, don't open it, I pry open the metal fastener and lift the flap. I lay it flat on the table, put two fingers in, and slide out some articles and a photograph. The photograph doesn't make sense to me at first, and then it does, for a brief, sickening instant. Scraps of rotting fabric and something worse. And I look away and catch a glimpse of the headlines. River Oaks, Houston neighborhood. Remains found. I push everything back into the envelope and press the flap over the fastener as my stomach heaves into my throat.
Who hired you?
My voice is shaking.
I was just starting out on the force when your daughter disappeared,
Alex says conversationally, without answering or touching the envelope, as if suddenly we've been lifted out of this nightmarish Waffle House and dropped into the getting-to-know-you phase of an awkward first date.
I hated it. I was out in a couple of years. Believe me, to walk away from those benefits just gets harder, so if you find out it's not for you, you have to leave fast.
He laughs once.
My wife evidently thought the same thing.
Who hired you? I repeat.
Nobody.
And what the hell are you trying to do here? A waitress walks up with a tall plastic carafe in one hand, and, unbelievably, Alex gestures toward his cup and lets her fill it up. He gives her a little nod of thanks and watches as she walks away, then turns back to me. As he opens his mouth, I feel a buzz at my hip. Tom must be wondering where I am. What time is it anyway?
Anna, I was there. Don't you want to know why they never found your daughter?
I assume gross incompetence was an issue. The sound of my first name in his scraping voice makes me so angry I can barely contain myself. It's time to end this farcical conversation. I have to go, I say, standing up. Distantly, I feel my phone vibrate in my purse a second time.
You want the truth, so do I.
Well, I have reason to believe the truth is worse than we thought. What's in that envelope? He's talking faster and faster, jabbing his pointer finger at the unspeakable thing burning a yellow rectangle on the bottom of my cornea.
They're not even going to compare it with your daughter's dental records. Julie Whitaker's been removed from the missing persons database. I checked.
Because she's home, I whisper, lying on the sofa under an afghan.
Brr, another text.
They think the remains are 8 to 10 years old, Anna. They think it's a 13-year-old girl, but Julie's name won't come up at all.
Why should it?
Unless you introduce a reasonable doubt that the woman living in your house is not who she says she is.
The woman living in my house? I repeat, like an idiot.
Could you just do me a favor? Could you get me a sample of her DNA, some hair off a brush, ideally?
Brr, brr.
I pull the phone out of my purse, look down briefly, read Tom's latest text, and feel suddenly dizzy. But Alex goes on.
I have a friend in the crime lab who will run a hair sample and see if it's a match. We don't go to anyone, and no one finds out, not even her, until we have an answer.
I'm sorry. I push the envelope back across the table like an entree I can't finish.
Put it this way. You're sure it's her?
Okay.
So this is just confirmation.
Peace of mind. He looks at me shrewdly.
Brr. But you're not sure, are you?
Not entirely. He's still seated with his hands folded in front of him on the table, but it feels like he's looming over me, reaching into the innermost recesses of my mind, putting his fingers all over everything. It's the kind of violation that implicates you through and through, like failing to set the alarm, or leaving the door unlocked, or simply living in a world where anyone can walk into your kitchen and take your daughter away at knife point. A world where that can happen is a world where I can fail at every act of faith and trust. A world where the best thing that ever happened to me is just another mask for the worst thing. And the worst thing that ever happened to me fits inside a manila envelope, fits into two words, really. Remains found.
I'm sure, I say.
You have my number, he says. He doesn't offer me the envelope again.
Call me,
if you want to talk more. My phone is buzzing continuously now. I have to get home to Tom and face the punishments already raining down on us for my doubts. I start toward the door. It feels like I've been gone forever. Impossible to believe I stormed out of Carol Morse's office just a few hours ago. But the thought of the missed therapy appointments suddenly gives me a use for the wrecking ball in the booth behind me. I turn and take a couple of quick steps back toward the table.
I don't give a damn about that,
I say, refusing to look at the envelope again.
But if you really want to help me, find out where she goes on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons.
She leaves the house at 1:30. Follow her.
I thought you'd never ask.
This is not pro bono, I say.
This is for me. I'll pay.
Okay, he nods. But you do something for me too, Anna. Search for a band called Gretchen at Midnight. Look for a video on YouTube. Tell me whose face you see. And if it changes your mind, call me.
Vi woke up at 7 in the morning with a stiff jaw and sticky yellow stars behind her eyes. Will was passed out beside her, snoring and rasping. For a moment, she didn't remember why her jaw hurt. Then she stepped into the bathroom and saw the shower curtain half pulled down and the shampoo bottles arrested mid-roll in the tub, remembered his hands holding her neck against the wall under a rain of water. When he'd released her, she'd grabbed at the curtain blindly to keep from falling, with predictable results. She'd stayed huddled there, listening to the sound the water made hitting the plastic curtain over her head, waiting for him to come back and yell at her for the mess she'd made. He never came. It was the first time Will had hit her, but not the first time she'd thought he was going to. She was already intimately familiar with the song he'd sing when he woke up after a night like last night. How could he trust her with her past? Dancing for all those men, women, too, more than dancing. That was the first verse. Then came the chorus, in which he avoided last night's sour names, just cried and swore he'd never believe he was enough for her. Second verse, same as the first. Then, best of all, the bridge. Didn't she understand he'd been betrayed before? He was a virgin until he was 22 because his college girlfriend said she wasn't ready, but then it turned out she was sleeping with someone else. He'd been a perfect gentleman, and she'd betrayed him. Vi always pretended she was hearing it for the first time. He'd cry and cry and beg for forgiveness, but somehow it would still be her fault. And his memory of having apologized and groveled and told her the humiliating story once again would only make the next time worse. She went back to the bedroom and looked at him. Will was beautiful in repose. He had a jaw like a statue's, hard and rounded at the same time, and his bluish whisker shadow made his skin look like marble. She imagined putting her hand on him where his had been on her, just under the jaw, then leaning down and squeezing hard. His eyelids, almost translucent, fluttered, and she suddenly put a hand to her own tender jaw. The bruises were forming just under the jawline, where they could be swaddled in a scarf or turtleneck. No one would have to see. Almost as if he knew just where to grab. Almost as if he'd done this before. The bathroom took only a few minutes to clean up. He would cry, yes, and apologize, but he wouldn't want to see any reminders. He'd want to have sex first thing, when her breasts were still slick with his tears, and she would accommodate him gently, lovingly. There was, even now, a calculating little twitch in her groin at the thought. She lay back down in her underwear and carefully arranged herself in bed next to his still form, draping the sheet over them both, tucking them in. She closed her eyes. She wasn't going to be able to go back to sleep, but that was fine. She used the time behind her eyelids to make a plan. The plan involved Seattle. Will had been booking gigs there to get her out of town. He was worried she'd fall in with her old crowd again, Lena's crowd, even though none of them would talk to her after the breakup. Most of them she hadn't known well in the first place, so when she was out playing gigs with Will and saw them once in a while, it wasn't strange for them to pretend they didn't recognize her. She did the same. It didn't happen much, though, because they weren't playing lesbian dive bars anymore. Will had called up two of his old bandmates and said, "I have a girl singer."
Vi's haunting vocals were laid over electric guitar, and she was singing lead, not backup. The lyrics sounded to her like badly written suicide notes, but you couldn't hear them all that well, so it didn't matter much. Will was right. People liked to see a girl fronting a band. It didn't seem to matter what kind of ripped-up clothes she was wearing. Their faces turned up toward her like flowers, like she was an angel of light. And sometimes she really felt like one. The stage lights bleached out her eyeballs under the lids, so she felt like she was staring straight up into heaven. And if the lights left dark splotches in her vision after she opened them, it just meant she had to look at the world around her a little less. The band was called, depressingly, Midnight. But after a while it became clear that people were showing up for Vi. And in a moment of inspiration, Will suggested they change the name of the band to Gretchen at Midnight, after some children's story his mom had read to him when he was little. She was ready to say goodbye to Vi by this time anyway, and just as she suspected, people started calling her Gretchen. She liked it. Gretchen was a healthier name than Violet, and Gretchen was a healthier girl. Not a night bloomer, but a bright yellow flower. Her hair grew longer, and she started bleaching streaks into it. And the blonder it got, the better it looked with the dark T-shirts and jeans she wore on stage, and everything was more or less fine. At least, it was in a holding pattern until she slipped and said something stupid that exposed her, lethally, two different ways at once. Dave and Len were talking about hitting up strip clubs after a gig, and they mentioned the Black Rose. A little high off the crowd that night, she cracked a dumb joke about the dykes who went there for fresh fish, and Will, with his occasional radar for such things, looked at her with a sudden uncanny flicker of recognition and said, "How do you know?" She didn't bother denying it. He'd kissed the tiny black rose on her ribcage 100 times without knowing what it stood for. Now he stared at her and she felt the tattoo burning under her T-shirt, its meaning suddenly unmistakable. It was over. A fact that she knew right away, and he, dangerously, didn't. From that point on, whenever she stood on the stage glowing like a street sign, he didn't see Vi anymore. He saw Star dancing under the hot lights. Star, who should have been long gone. After shows, no matter how happy he seemed with the band's share of the door, he said, "Every single person in that room wanted you." She just shrugged, because wasn't that kind of the point? At first it turned him on. When they got home, he'd grab her hard, lift her shirt and rub his thumb over the tattoo until the skin under her left breast was bruised and raw, fuck her like he was trying to own her from the inside out. Useless, she could have told him. Nobody owned what was in there, not even her. But it wasn't long before disgust eclipsed desire, and then his eyes went black, and fucking her wasn't enough. He had to get in some other way. The shower rod had broken, and she could feel more breakage on the way. It was time to get out, but her next situation had to be something different. No more Lena's, no more Will's. She was done playing a rag doll, whether she got tucked in at night or thrown against the wall. Anyway, the band was starting to get too popular. At almost every show now, she saw a few glowing rectangles held aloft to record, and she didn't like it. She knew she'd have to plan tight and move fast, because these days Will never let her out of his sight for long. When they were all on the road together, he played her guardian angel, meaning she and Will had a cheap motel room while the rest of the band crashed on sofas. One day soon, he'd start making her crack the door open while she peed, and she'd never be alone again, not even in the John. She started drinking a beer with the band before the show, in the round on the house that took the sting out of dismal pay. Will liked her taking part in this pre-show ritual. He'd warned her enough times, crushing his 5th or 6th empty while she kept herself sharp, not to act any better than she was. The tide would eventually turn, of course, but she thought she knew approximately how much longer she could drink with the guys before that happened. She snuggled up closer to Will to buy herself a little more time, ignoring Dave and Len as much as she could with them all crammed into a booth together, and made sure everyone saw her hit the ladies' room just before they all went on stage together. Will laughed and said it was stage fright, but when the time was right, missing this step would give her an excuse to disappear immediately after the set. Every time they played Seattle, she felt like a kid on a swing, scanning the ground as she whooshed forward, looking for the perfect moment to jump off. She didn't know exactly who she was looking for until she saw him. A man in the audience at the Plowman she'd seen before, always alone. Just a man, but that night on stage, as the hot red lights lay on her face like a mask she could slip out from under, she sensed him like a wet stain on the front of a blouse, felt him watching her, and when she saw his dark face ringed by lighter faces, a hole in the pale crowd, she knew. She closed her eyes, let her voice hover in the alto register for a few lines, and then reached out for him with her soprano, scaling the stage lights with her voice and bursting upward into the quiet dark at their center like a surfacing diver. That night in October, with the mantle of drizzle descending again, a curtain that wouldn't lift for the next 7 months, she jumped. 6. By the time I get home, I've forgotten all about the video and Gretchen Farber because she's gone. Julie is gone. I want to scream at Tom for letting her leave the house. Of course he doesn't know about the miscarriage. He doesn't know she's supposed to stay off her feet for 24 hours. He doesn't know she might be bleeding, she might be hurting. But still, when I get home, she has been gone for 5 hours with no word, and he is frantic. We drive up and down Memorial, stopping in coffee shops and stores, asking if anyone has seen her. One barista at Starbucks says he thinks he saw her get into an SUV outside. We aren't so crazed that we don't think of Jane, out somewhere in Tom's SUV. When Jane's phone goes straight to voicemail, the way it does when it's dead, that's when the scenarios begin to spiral out of control. Some men from Mexico have been looking for Julie and have finally found her, perhaps when the girls were together, and they've taken both of them. Or it was Jane who picked Julie up, but they were T-boned at an intersection and are now lying comatose in a hospital. Catastrophic scenes, tantalizing because they're impossible, like lightning striking twice in the same spot. I yell at Tom, and Tom yells back, and then we hug each other tightly, and Tom calls the police. He's on hold with them when the two girls finally stumble into our kitchen after dark, sopping wet and giggling like mad. It's the laughter that unhinges me. For the past 4 hours since I came home to find both girls gone, I have been sitting at this kitchen table believing with a morbid certainty that this is my fault. That going to Julie's therapist and, worse, meeting with that Mercado person, some crank who got my work number off the faculty website, was a betrayal that meant I was unworthy of having Julie back. As I made my way through the list of Jane's friends, Bella, April, then further, to friends she probably doesn't hang out with anymore but whose parents' numbers we have, and Tom shouted between hold times at Detectives Harris and Overby and anyone else who would listen, I knew, deep down, that they were gone because of me. And now they are here, and they are laughing. Where have you been? I ask quietly. They're still in their sister bubble, Julie and Janie, Janie and Julie, just like old times, though Julie, already detecting something wrong, has started to sober up a little. Oh my God, so many places. Jane puts a hand on Julie's shoulder to steady herself. You could start by explaining why you're soaking wet. Oh, she says, yes, that was mostly an accident. There's something a little hectic in Jane's voice, but I'm in no mood to listen to it. She can see my expression, though. You tell her, Julie, she likes you. She explodes into nervous titters. Julie starts to explain. The traffic was bad on the way home, so we stopped to eat, and then Jane wanted to show me the sculpture garden, but it was already closed. We jumped the wall, Jane says. I've done it a lot, but this is the first time I've ever been chased off by a security guard. She's giggling again. But then we went to that big fountain in the middle of the roundabout in Herman Park. We wanted to make a wish, and things got a little out of hand, and we went swimming. She was taking money out of the fountain, says Julie, starting to laugh a little again. Well, I didn't have any change. I didn't think the wishes would mind being recycled. They've already forgotten the expression on my face that stopped them in their tracks a moment before. In their minds, they're still tumbling together into the broad bowl of the giant fountain, chasing each other through the arcing spray while cars honk all around. It's too much to bear. I get up from the kitchen table. I don't even know what I'm doing or which one of them I'm moving toward, but Julie sees me coming and melts into the doorframe. Without breaking stride, I slap Jane's cheek.
Anna!
Tom shouts.
What were you thinking?
I demand.
We must have left 2 dozen messages. What the hell happened?
Tom crosses over to where Julie is hugging the doorframe and puts one arm around her. He is not standing between Jane and me, but he looks like he is ready to be in an instant. Jane holds her hand to her face, stunned.
You hit me.
Baby, I'm sorry, is what I mean to say, but harsher words come out.
You owe your father and me an apology.
You hit me, says Jane.
You fucking bitch!
Jane,
Tom steps in with a warning tone.
My phone must have died. Jeez, oh, look if you want.
She fumbles through her bag until she finds the phone, pushes the on button, and waves it around.
See? Dead.
It's your responsibility to keep it charged. Always. You know that.
Since when do you care?
Jane drops the phone back in her purse.
This isn't even about me. I've been 5 minutes late before and you haven't even noticed.
You're 5 hours late, not 5 minutes, says Tom. We had no idea where you were.
I miss dinner all the time, Jane says. Nobody's ever hit me before. Hell, nothing I do around here raises an eyebrow.
She laughs.
Why is it different when she's with me? Is it because you're afraid something will happen to the one who matters?
You can take care of yourself, I spit.
What's that supposed to mean? You let her go once.
I'm yelling now.
You watched her walk out the door.
Jane's eyes widen. She comes over to me, close enough for me to feel how much taller than me she is. She raises a hand, and for a moment I think she's going to slap me. Instead, she points to Julie.
Blame me if you want to.
But don't forget, she's standing right over there. You can ask her whatever questions you want.
My eyes follow the pointing finger, and for the first time I notice Julie's hair, which is wet and plastered to her head like Jane's but starting to dry. I see the short, feathery red cap fluffed upward at the hairline by a cowlick, and for a moment I can't even speak.
I told you she would freak out, Jane says, but nobody pays attention now.
I'm sorry, Julie whispers.
Why?
I take a step toward Julie, reach out a hand, and tentatively touch the place over her ears where her long, silvery pale hair used to be. I ruffle the side hair, pull it forward, check that it's real. Then I start crying. I can't help it.
I can't believe this, says Jane. She's the one who left the house today without telling anyone where she was going. She's the one who disappeared. Not me. Not me!
There's a bandage on Jane's left ring finger that has come loose and is flapping around. When she sees that no one will try to stop her, she doesn't bother stomping, just rushes upstairs and slams the door to her room. Julie follows, but slowly, one foot in front of the other, wading through my grief like it's a current in a flood, like she might lose her footing and be swept away. She looks as if she has lost more children than I can possibly imagine. My mother slapped me once. The summer after 5th grade, Angie Pugh invited me to spend part of my summer vacation with her family in Northeast Harbor. My mother, who had strong ideas about raising girls, reluctantly agreed, but I had outgrown my swimsuit, and shopping for a new one was torture. She stood behind me in the corner of the dressing room, watching with a frown as I tugged each suit over my newly widened hips. The suit we finally picked out had polka dots and a full, ruffled skirt that hung halfway to my knees. I had maxed out my growth spurt the year before and would never be an inch over 5 feet. The first day of my vacation with Angie, she made a face at the polka-dotted suit and said, "Here, take one of mine." She opened up a drawer full of bikinis from the juniors department, bathing suits my mom would never even let me take off the rack. I tried a crocheted bikini with a halter top and beaded hip ties that clicked when I walked. Angie looked at me appraisingly and said, "Now I get what it's supposed to look like."
She sounded jealous, but only a little. After all, she was the one with the vacation home in Northeast Harbor, and I was the one with the Catholic mother. For 10 days, we played tetherball and ping-pong, walked to the old-fashioned soda fountain for Coke floats, told each other ghost stories under the covers with a flashlight. At the end of the vacation, I gave Angie her suit back, but I hadn't thought about the tan lines. My mother, who did not believe in knocking, came in while I was changing. As I cried from the sting, she yelled, "Do you know what the men who saw you were thinking? Do you?" I didn't believe her. To me, it was just a body. But when summer ended, I found out that to the boys in my school, the men in the streets, to anyone who looked, it was more than that. It was an open book full of horrible secrets, a dirty magazine anyone could paw through. My mother never hit me again, but I hated her for being right. My mother died before Julie's hips ever filled out a skirt. She never saw me get my first heart stop. That moment when you look at your girl in a certain light and see that she'll eventually become a woman. And it reminds you of every boy who put a pencil up your skirt when you walked ahead of him on the stairs. Every man who stared at you at the bus stop. Every honk on the street. Every leering comment. You remember being alone, gloriously alone, reading a book in a sundress, feeling the grass prickling your thighs and the sun on your forearms, and then realizing that you weren't alone at all, as a man you were ashamed to feel afraid of walked up and asked if he could put sunscreen on your back. You look at your daughter and it all comes back, every microsecond when you felt that twinge surge of shame and fear, but this time it's outside of you, happening to a body that feels like yours but doesn't belong to you, so there's no way to protect it. It stopped my heart back then. I was scared for her, scared of her. I held my breath and thought, this will be over soon enough. By the time she's a teenager, she'll wise up like I did. She didn't make it.
How dare you?
Tom is angrier at me than I've ever seen him. Leaning down to force eye contact, but still looking every inch of the foot taller than me he is.
We do not do that, Anna. We don't do that to our kids.
You were as scared as I was.
I don't care how scared you were,
he says, his frame growing larger every second.
We agreed. Never in our house. I saw too much of it in mine.
And how are your sisters doing, Tom? I say, raising my eyes to his suddenly.
Scared shitless of their father, he snaps back. And probably their husbands, too. Is that what you want?
And how many of them were kidnapped and sold to the highest bidder? I yelled.
And how many of them were raped every day for 8 years? Anna, they were safe, Tom. They were kept safe.
He puts his finger right up in my face and bites off every word with a growl.
If you think that's how it felt growing up with my father, you don't know the first goddamn thing about safe.
But I'm beyond reason now. The screaming has unleashed something too big to make a sound. I think I am sobbing, but then I realize I am only gasping, again and again, struggling for air. I feel dizzy and my vision clouds. The next minute I come to, still standing in the same place, crushed against Tom's chest. It's as if he's pushing the air back into my lungs, and the big black thing in me dissolves into ordinary tears.
Why did she do it?
I say, sobbing against him.
Why? You know, Jane,
he says.
She lost track of time. And Julie, I think she was just feeling cooped up, trapped. You know what she's been through.
He shudders and gives a deep sigh.
I was as worried as you and as angry. But now that we know they're okay, honestly, I think it was probably good for the girls to get some bonding time.
I meant her hair. Tom releases me, takes a step backward, and stares.
You can't be serious.
I know he's kept up with Jane all these years, fighting through the traps she's set to keep us away, while I was too happy to believe she didn't want my interference. But Julie, how has he kept up with her, too? How does he still have that connection from before? How did he know to move straight to Julie and hold her close when I went straight to Jane and did what I did?
They're like strangers.
He looks at me with disbelief.
Anna, that's how all mothers of teenage girls feel.
But Julie, as Carol Morse reminded me, is an adult. Tom doesn't know about Carol Morse and the miscarriage, Alex Mercado and the envelope. He doesn't look into those eyes and wonder if they're the right shade of blue and then think to himself, would I even know the difference? I could tell Tom everything, but I'm the one who let the poison in, and we're already being punished for it. What better proof of my sacrilege than this horrible feeling of not recognizing my own children? Kicking them out of the nest for having the wrong scent, striking them when I want to hold them. All because they disappear at odd times of the day and night, and I never know what they will look like when they return.
You're right, I say. I know you're right.
Tom and I can afford only one fight a night. We are too newly repaired for more. I allow myself to be taken to bed. When he is asleep, I slip into the bathroom with my phone, mute the volume, and search until I find a YouTube video called Gretchen at Midnight at Chapel Pub, October 2nd, 2014. I push the triangle to play the clip and watch as Julie's face, no bigger than a smudged white thumbprint on the screen, opens its mouth under stage lights and silently sings. Violet sang for the first time in Lena's backyard. Violet never thought of it as her backyard, although she'd lived there almost a year, long enough to dye her hair blue and then bleach it and clip it short and start growing it out all over again as a ripe strawberry blonde. Short hair was nothing special in this company, of course, but she could tell Lena liked it better show pony long, no matter the color. Lena had friends over, and they'd all been drinking. It had gotten dark and a little chilly, so they lit up the fire pit out back and dragged chairs from the kitchen around it. Lena never smoked pot, so Violet usually avoided it too. It should have been a sign to her that she was ready for a change when, this time, she took the joint that appeared on her left as if by magic, held in Susan's hand.
V, said Lena,
but she turned and shrugged almost immediately as Violet took a long pull. Violet relished the small opportunity to remind Lena she was not a knick-knack picked up somewhere exotic for a song. Nobody except Lena operated on the assumption that getting Violet off the pole was the same as having bought and paid for her, but it lingered on the air like the smell of fireworks, the scent of a dangerous excitement that was over before anyone else could enjoy it. Expelling a lungful of pot smoke without a sound, Violet handed the joint back to Susan, who grinned handsomely and passed it on. Once rid of the joint, Susan pulled a guitar from behind her seat.
"Troubadour time already," said Susan's girlfriend, Beck, from across the circle where she was wrapped in a woven blanket.
But Susan didn't sing a love song. She began by strumming the guitar with her bare knuckles and then started up a picking pattern that reminded Violet of running water, dissolving the chords into individual notes. The joint was loosening the knots in Violet's limbs one by one, and the tension of her status as a trophy girlfriend, who should be seen and not heard, began unfurling like cream in coffee. Susan's fingers on the strings plucked at her arm hairs, her leg hairs, the hairs on the back of her neck. Then Susan started singing in a throaty alto, a folk song. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. The song was strangely familiar. Or maybe she was just stoned. And Violet's mind raced to grab the tail of each line, never quite catching up. Then the guitar's rounded edge bumped against her bare knee, sending its shiver up her thigh to her cunt. And for the first time, she was attracted to a woman. Really attracted. And it wasn't Lena. Beck was looking over at Susan with an expression in which patience and paranoia mingled. She was high, too. But most of the others were still chatting and laughing and clinking beer bottles and wine glasses onto the ground, or scraping sandaled feet across the concrete to grab another bottle from inside. Then Violet started to sing. At first, she sang along with Susan, and then she started to split on the rhyming words. Veil, whale, seas, me. Soaring upward in response to Susan's emphasis, following the bumps of her voice the way she used to follow John David's.
And then, finally, she peeled her voice off the back of Susan's, as if she'd been riding along on the back of a bird and, catching the feeling of flight, spread her own wings. After that, it was like dancing. She and Susan breathed in together and spent their breath together, vibrating like two strings on the same instrument. Outside the pocket of air where they were singing, wine glasses dangled and beer bottles hung in the air, suspended halfway to parted lips. When the notes knit themselves back into chords, Violet knew it was done, and the high flew out of her just like that, leaving a sleepy vacancy. The women in the circle clapped and exclaimed over Violet as if she were a precocious child or an animal that could talk. Someone said, "Lena, where have you been hiding this one?" as though she hadn't been to all their poetry readings and dinner parties this summer, not to mention the Black Rose, where she'd watched them get lap dances from her former co-workers. While Lena lapped up the praise, Susan put a hand on her arm and asked, "Where did you learn to sing like that?" "Church," she answered truthfully, and because she was still a little high, the word seemed to encompass everything she meant by it, which was John David and the darkness at the center of light and the things both ugly and sweet she would offer anyone if it meant survival. Susan nodded, and Violet thought for a moment she really understood. What could have happened to Susan that she did? "If you ever want to join me for an open mic sometime," Susan said and patted her arm twice with a wink. Violet knew by the prickling in her skin and by Lena's eyes on her that the circle had become charged with a dangerous energy. She imagined herself transforming into the sputtering, sparkling Catherine wheel that would burn down Susan and Beck's life together, forcing them to decide who would keep the condo in Northwest and the restaurant they co-owned and their 4-year-old son. She weighed all that against the pot-fueled flickering in her cunt that she could exhaust in a single evening, or at most a few weeks. It was tempting. She snuffed out the tiny flame. "I don't think I could," she said. Susan was too complicated. Anyway, saying no to Susan had an upside. Lena was so grateful that when the next chance came around, as Violet had known it would, Lena said yes. And then Violet was singing folk music with trios in little cafes, filling out harmonies here and there with other kinds of bands, too, and she felt the satisfaction of belatedly scrubbing away the last of Star the Stripper with the red waterfall of hair down her back and flipping into her new identity, Violet the singer with the strawberry blonde bob that was growing out little by little. She drifted from gig to gig, band to band, until she ran into a male drummer. Will was single. So all she had to break up was a band. 7. When I wake up the next morning, Tom is outside cleaning the pool. I watch him through the bedroom window as he stands at the pool's pebbled ledge, sweeping the long pole of the vacuum slowly across the bottom like a gondolier. With each measured stroke, last night feels farther away. The tingle in my palm from slapping Jane, Tom's yelling, and most of all, the face on my cell phone screen cradled in my palm as I crouched in the bathroom. It's all gone now, washed clean by sleep and early morning showers. A mistake. A misunderstanding. A blonde girl in a blurry video. I grab a pair of fresh jeans out of the laundry basket and pull them on, then feel a lump in the back pocket and find Detective Overby's card, pulped in the washing machine and fuzzed from the dryer, unreadable. I throw it in the trash. I take my coffee outside and settle into a deck chair to watch Tom's rhythmic movements. It's one of those rare, sparkling, rain-cooled mornings that occasionally graces Houston in June, a throwback to March, a day you could almost mistake for an ordinary summer day in a more hospitable climate. The shadows of the tall pine trees move on the deck. The breezes that languidly stir their tops back and forth barely reach me. A yellow worm of late-season oak pollen drops into my mug and I fish it out. We may have our problems, but, after all, we are a family again. Husband and wife and 2 beautiful daughters, together at last. The door opens and Jane comes out, rolling a suitcase behind her. "Sweetie?" Tom calls as she wheels the suitcase to the car, ignoring us. I hear a car door open, then close again with a thump. As she passes by the deck without her suitcase, Tom says, "Jane?"
I'm going back. I bought my ticket last night. I'm staying with April tonight, and she's taking me to the airport tomorrow morning.
Tom turns off the vacuum and leans the handle against a tree.
Sweetie, we talked about this. Maybe you need some time to...
I want to go back now.
Tom doesn't ask why. Neither of us do.
Will you take me to April's house?
Sure. Sure,
he says. She disappears back inside. He turns to me. It's my cue.
I'll apologize, I say.
And then when he looks down at his sandaled feet,
I'm sorry.
He doesn't look up as I walk past, but his anger is palpable. I go upstairs and knock on Jane's door, and when there is no reply, open it an inch at a time, softly saying,
Hey.
Jane is rummaging through her closet. She looks at me over her shoulder and then returns immediately to what she is doing, which is stuffing an open duffel bag full of things she is apparently choosing more or less at random. Behind me, the shower starts running, and I think of Julie's new hair. I wonder how much of the excess dye will wash down the drain, whether the red will stain the tub. Then I snap back to Jane, standing in front of me, back turned.
I'm so sorry, Jane. There was no excuse for that. We were just... I was so worried.
Jane yanks a sweater off a hanger and throws it into the bag.
Be worried, she says. You can do it without me around.
I take a step inside the door and close it behind me. She whirls.
Did I say you could come in?
Jane, please.
Please what? Please stay out of the way so you can be with your other daughter, your real daughter, the one you care about. Please be fine so you don't have to give me any of your precious time or listen to what I say.
Please stay.
She looks at me with such longing, her jaw set and quivering like she used to when she was a child.
Your father needs you.
Her eyes drop to the floor, and when they come up, her chin isn't shaking anymore. I'll go out for breakfast with him on the way to April's. Would that make him happy?
I think he would like that, yes.
I'll miss him. I'll miss both of you. All of you.
She wipes her eyes with her flannel shirt sleeve.
I just can't be here right now. It's making me crazy. She's my sister, too, you know? I missed her, too. I was frightened, too, all those years.
She looks around the room, at her closet.
I hate this room. Sleeping here still gives me nightmares.
We couldn't move, I say.
I know. You wanted her to be able to find you, and she did, so that's all that matters. I get it.
She goes back to stuffing more things into the bag.
I don't even mind that you've barely asked me about my school situation at all.
Jane,
don't. I'll figure it out on my own, I always do.
She finishes her job and grabs the bag off the floor, throws it on her bed.
Just don't take it out on me, because she found you, not the other way around.
There's a gentle knock at the door, and Jane pushes past me to open it. Julie is standing in the doorway, holding a pair of black high-top tennis shoes in her hands. With her short hair plastered wetly to her skull, she looks older and smaller, almost bird-like.
You'll need these, she says, holding out the shoes. You can keep them, Jane says, her voice roughening around the edges. I need a new pair anyway.
Are you sure? Says Julie.
Yeah,
Jane says. I want you to have them.
Thanks, says Julie.
You have my email address, right? Jane asks. I feel like I should be leaving the girls alone to say goodbye, but they are directly blocking the door, so I just stand, hands in jean pockets, waiting.
Yeah, Julie says. Thanks for hanging out. I had a nice time.
Me too, says Jane. She lunges forward and gives Julie a quick hug.
I love you. I'm glad you're home.
Then she turns to zip up the bag on the bed. She grabs a stack of notebooks from her desk and loops her book bag over one shoulder. By the time she turns back to the door, Julie is gone, the door to her room shut. I reach out my hand for a bag, but Jane shakes her head, grabs the duffel, and moves out the door. She makes it all the way down the stairs at a brisk march, thump, 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 the heavy, purposeful Jane step as if she's shipping out. I follow in her footsteps more softly and slowly. Tom gets up from the kitchen table when he sees her and steps toward her, reaching out for the bags. She surrenders everything to him, even the notebooks, and he silently carries them out to the car. I keep shadowing her until we reach the back door, where Julie must have hovered long ago, a knife at her back, before taking her life.